Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. This is the History of the World podcast, unscripted. Hello, Hot Worlders. Welcome to the History of the World podcast with me, Chris Hasler. And today we're going to have an unscripted special. At the moment, we're writing episodes for members of the History of the World podcast Illuminati who have qualified for that pleasure. And the next one on the menu is the evolution of religion. Now, as you can imagine, that's quite an extensive episode, so that I'm sure we'll be publishing for you next week. But for this week, we're going to do an unscripted retrospective special. Though it was quite popular when we did this last time, and what basically we want to do is have a look at what was going on for the History of the World podcast on this very day in the previous years of its existence. Now, we're just over a month away from the podcast's fifth birthday, so we can dip back onto the previous 4 years and find out what we were talking about. So we start 1 year ago. What were we talking about 1 year ago? Well, this was the occasion of an episode within Volume 4, so within the volume that we're currently covering. And it was on the Icelandic poet, historian, author called Snorri Sturluson. And Snorri Sturluson was alive when Iceland was reaching its final years of independence, and he was actually quite heavily involved in the politics of Iceland as well. He was quite a wealthy man, and he was invited to be the law speaker of the High Court in Iceland. As such, he became very friendly with King Haakon IV of Norway, and he went to Norway where he worked on writing on the history of Norway at the request of King Haakon. And then eventually he convinced Haakon to let him go back home where he could assume political duties in Iceland again. But the situation in Iceland had become very volatile, and not least of all for Snorri himself, as we find out now. One of the notable opponents of Snorri was his own brother, Sigvatr, and he was now being ably assisted by his own son, Sturla Sigvatsson. Snorri was suitably concerned by the threat of his brother and nephew that he would prepare for military conflict, which we realise to be a last resort in the lands of Iceland. This may have only been posturing from Snorri's perspective, possibly believing that with King Haakon of Norway on his side that anybody would be foolish to take him on. It may be the case that Sigvatr took the threat seriously though, and amassed his own force of hundreds to counterbalance Snorri's army, and it was enough to call Snorri's bluff, as Snorri decided not to go through with the conflict. Sighvatr sensed that this was a sign of his younger brother's unwillingness to fight and that the opportunity existed to attack his brother, the spineless Snorri Sturluson, who fled into refuge elsewhere in Iceland. This conflict would be part of a greater struggle for Iceland. The most prominent Icelandic chieftains would have to decide whether they were for the Norwegian Union with King Haakon or against it. As other chieftains decided to pledge loyalty to King Haakon, it wouldn't be too surprising to consider that Haakon may have seen his personal relationship with Snorri as an increasingly expendable one. So Snorri's lack of desire to engage in military battles was now playing against him because other Icelandic chieftains were willing to fight for what they believed in. It was certainly not unusual for Icelandic warriors to pledge themselves to fight on Norwegian soil during their own civil war for a share of the spoils. So even though we believe that military exchanges within Iceland itself could be damaging for all parties, it wasn't as if Icelanders were battle shy. Opportunities for great wealth for Icelanders was limited, and so the attraction of an alliance with King Haakon may have been difficult to resist for those who were setting their sights higher than their current lot. Couple this with the fact that your rivals were making the switch and the possibility of being left behind would have been too much to prevent any hesitance. It would actually be a son of Snorri, who is known to us as Orreika Snorrason, who would lead an army in defence of his father and against the forces of his uncle Sighvatr and his cousin Sturla. So Snorri was safe for now, but Iceland was in turmoil. Despite Snorri's best attempts to re-establish himself as the most powerful man in Iceland, he would successfully be exiled to Norway by his brother and nephew, who would now have to battle against other powerful families in Iceland, such as the Húkdaeir family clan, headed by the notable Gissur Þorvaldsson, himself a great-grandson of Jón Loftsson. So it was now Gissur who was posing a threat to Sighvatr, while Snorri was in exile in Norway with King Haakon. Snorri's relationship with Haakon on this occasion was full of distrust now that Snorri's value to Haakon was diminished. In the meantime, back in Iceland, Snorri's brother Sighvatr and his son Sturla were on a collision course with his rival Gissur Thorvaldsson. Gissur had amassed a large force to counterbalance the forces of Sighvatr, and he did this by striking up an anti-Sturlung alliance with a man called Holben Ungi Arnorsson of the Ausbjerninga family clan. The two armies would meet on the 21st of August 1238 at the Battle of Ulligstadr. The outcome was a victory for the alliance, who defeated the Sturlunga, also killing both Sighvatr Sturluson and his son Sturla Sighvatsson. It was after this battle that Snorri would approach King Haakon and request that he be allowed to return to Iceland, but King Haakon, who himself was growing ever distrustful of everyone around him due to the continuing civil war in Norway, denied Snorri passage to Iceland, fearing that he may be about to rally Icelanders against King Haakon, and instead for his political opponent and father-in-law, Duke Skúli Bårðsson. Snorri would famously declare the legendary phrase "Út vilek," which essentially means "I want to go." Despite Haakon denying Snorri passage, Skúli would arrange it against Haakon's orders. Snorri would return to Iceland and would find himself politically opposed to his former ally, King Haakon. It would appear that it would be at this time that King Haakon approached the victor at the Battle of Ulligstadr, Gissur Þorvaldsson, and they struck up an alliance. Haakon felt that Gissur was the right man to get behind in his quest to bring Iceland under his influence. and he now saw Snorri Sturluson as a threat to that aim. King Haakon was able to defeat and kill his father-in-law, Duke Skule, which was yet another blow for Snorri, who was now a primary target for King Haakon, who is believed to have sent an instruction to Gissur to either kidnap or kill Snorri. Subsequently, Gissur took a force of men to Snorri's home in Reykholt in 1241 with intentions to capture him. Snorri would not surrender himself to Gissur, which forced Gissur to issue the command to strike Snorri down. After Snorri cried out the words, "Ey skal hugtha," a direct protest against being struck down, he would be struck and killed, bringing an end to the life of Snorri Sturluson at the age of 62. Well, that was a discussion on Snorri Sturluson, who's very much a big part of all the Norse mythology, all of those writings, all of those epic sagas. Snorri Sturluson was a very fundamental part of that writing, and we often remember him for that rather than his political influence in Iceland. But that was Snorri Sturluson and an episode that was requested by a History of the World podcast Illuminati member, which is what we do. If you amass the right amount of donation to the podcast, we write special episodes for you. Anyway, moving on, that was what we was talking about 1 year ago. 2 years ago, we were talking about the Battle of Red Cliffs. And this is a different part of the world altogether. We seem to spend a lot of our time in Europe and Western Asia. It seems like it's a rarity when we talk about other parts of the world. But 2 years ago, yes, we were talking about China, and we were talking about it during the Classical Age. So this was after the Han Dynasty was on the brink of collapse, and independent warlords were gathering lands for themselves. And one very powerful man was called Cao Cao, and he was from the north. He was from the north of Han Dynasty lands, and his aim was to conquer the southern lands, and especially those controlled by Liu Bei and Sun Chun. So let's pick up the story of the build-up to the final battle, this Battle of Red Cliffs, and find out what the outcome was. Cao Cao, now securing the lands of North China and the northern frontier, had now managed to gain an absolute authority over the imperial government, despite the fact that Emperor Qian was now in his 20s. He was simply a symbolic emperor for Han China, with no freedom to rule. Cao Cao was named as the Chancellor of Han China before turning his focus south to the Yangtze River and beyond. He already knew that he would have to tackle Sun Quan when he did cross the river. We mentioned that Liu Bei had fled southwards from Cao Cao's side of the river to the Jing province. Jing province was being governed by a man called Liu Biao, who had a natural territorial enemy in the young and ambitious Sun Quan. Liu Biao died of an illness just as Cao Cao was carrying out his southward invasion, and Liu Bei fled with the son of Liu Biao, whose name was Liu Qi. Cao Cao captured a large number of the Jing naval fleet and a large number of the populace that had not escaped alongside Liu Bei. Liu Bei had to consider his options, but he would choose to head to the lands of Sun Quan to secure an alliance against the ever-growing power of Cao Cao. Cao Cao had already sent envoys to Sun Quan to give him the message that he had absolutely no chance of success in opposing him, and that he should surrender. Sun Quan might have believed this was to be his only option, but for the emergence of Liu Bei and the prospect of a southern alliance. we can't be sure of the total numbers that sized up against each other for the fateful battle. But the Southern Alliance was measured in tens of thousands against Xiao Xiao's forces of hundreds of thousands. The Battle of Red Cliffs. Xiao Xiao would sail his war fleet full of soldiers from the captured port of Jiangling eastwards along the Yangtze River to meet with the combined forces of Liu Bei and Sun Quan approaching from the opposite direction from the port of Chaisang. The two fleets would meet halfway, and the forces of Liu Bei and Sun Quan would be more than a match for Xiao Xiao's larger force, and Xiao Xiao was forced to dock on the northern banks and stall for time while his army recuperated and prepared for another attack. It was at this point that Xiao Xiao, despite not being able to gain an advantage, was clearly superior in numbers and had every reason to feel confident about ultimate victory. Sun Quan would approve plans to officially surrender to Xiao Xiao, and after relaying the message to him, Sun Quan prepared a contingent of the most important ships to sail to the north bank of the Yangtze River to discuss the terms. Xiao Xiao must have been overjoyed to have believed that he had conquered Sun Quan with little in the way of damage and a naval fleet in his possession. If this seemed all too easy, then the reality of the move soon became apparent. The contingent of diplomatic ships sent to Xiao Xiao were ghost ships and soon turned into fire ships, set ablaze and sailing in the direction of the anchored fleet of Xiao Xiao. Xiao Xiao was helpless to stop these fire ships from colliding with his own acquired fleet, spreading the fires to them and destroying many ships containing many troops and many resources. This was a sudden and disastrous turn of events for Xiao Xiao, as he had been outwitted and tricked. Xiao Xiao's forces were sent into a panic, and this is where Liu Bei and Sun Quan attempted to capitalise by sailing over the Yangtze to engage in battle. This was their golden opportunity to resist Xiao Xiao, and Xiao Xiao realised that he was now on the back foot with his command in disarray. Xiao Xiao destroyed what was left of his naval fleet before it would fall into enemy hands and retreated northwards on foot. However, the lands north of this point of the Yangtze River were waterlogged and marshy, and escape at any speed and in any form of order was impossible. Many more of Xiao Xiao's soldiers simply couldn't make it north to safety. They were pursued by the Allied forces, to their detriment, however, not realising that they themselves would also be trapped in the marshlands. Their work had been done, though, and Xiao Xiao had to retreat north to regroup despite entering the conflict with superior numbers. So, as fearless as Xiao Xiao was, he couldn't get the job done, and China ended up spiralling into this really disorganised mess for a couple of centuries afterwards. And gone was the classical Han dynasty, which was a very much a stabilising influence over classical China for many centuries. Anyway, moving on, that was what we were talking about 2 years ago. If we go back another year, we were still in the classical world, but we were discussing what happened in the aftermath of the lifetime of Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great, we should all know by now, the Macedonian king who managed to conquer vast amounts of territory. Right across the Iranian plateau, the Middle East, and onto the Indus Valley, and certainly touching on the Indian cultures. But he also, en route, he managed to secure Egypt. Now, 3 years ago, we were discussing what happened after Alexander the Great's untimely death. And his vast empire was split up between a number of successors called Diadochi, which being the Greek name for successors or something like that anyway. But they were called the Diadochi. And one such man was Ptolemy. And it's from Ptolemy that we get the period of Ptolemaic Egypt, which is so deeply spoken about, especially when looking at the end of Ptolemaic Egyptian timelines with Queen Cleopatra, of course, who ultimately had to surrender her kingdom to the Romans. But how was it called Ptolemaic Egypt? Who was this man Ptolemy? We were discussing this 3 years ago. Macedonian kings such as Philip II and Alexander III had an entourage of bodyguards called Sarmatophylakes. One of Alexander's Sarmatophylakes was a man called Ptolemy, and he played an important role in Alexander the Great's Persian campaigns. There were many other important military generals and statesmen that had accompanied Alexander the Great before his death, and they were all keen to see whether they could benefit in the aftermath of their king's death. It was decided at a conference called the Partition of Babylon that the main military officers should become the new satraps of the Macedonian Persian Empire, and Ptolemy was rewarded with the satrapy of Egypt. Ptolemy appears to have embraced his new role and declared himself Pharaoh Ptolemy I Soter, and this was a key reason why Alexander the Great's body ended up in a tomb in the Egyptian city of Alexandria. One of Alexander the Great's generals was a man called Perdiccas, born of a noble family of Macedonia. Perdiccas would emerge from the partition of Babylon as the regent to the mentally challenged Philip III and a newborn Alexander IV. Perdiccas may have felt like he needed to be quite heavy-handed and strong-willed to effectively fill the shoes of Alexander the Great, and the other generals such as Ptolemy and Antipater would probably be questioning Perdiccas's credentials against their own. One Macedonian tradition was that the new king of Macedon should be the one to bury the deceased and outgoing king, and Ptolemy was very quick to prevent Perdiccas from this honour, and this is why Alexander the Great was entombed in Alexandria. Ptolemy prevented Perdiccas from taking the remains back to Macedon by capturing them and taking them to Egypt. Perdiccas would interpret this as a direct challenge against his position and would believe that Ptolemy, with the valuable satrapy of Egypt, could endeavour to depose Perdiccas, so Perdiccas would befriend Alexander the Great's mother, Olympias, and become betrothed to marry Alexander's sister, Cleopatra, whose previous wedding was the one we spoke of in episode 17, which was the occasion of the death of Alexander the Great's father, King Philip II of Macedon. This may well have upset Antipater, whose own daughter had been betrothed to Perdiccas. Antipater also recognised the danger of Perdiccas's assertions, especially as he had worked hard to maintain and protect the homelands of the Macedonian Empire. However, by this time, Antipater was a very old man of nearly 80 years old, so it would have been unlikely for him to want to actively oppose Perdiccas on the battlefield. Of course, as important as Ptolemaic Egypt was, it's overshadowed by ancient Egypt and everything that went on in those many centuries of Egyptian glory. And 4 years ago on the History of the World podcast, we were talking about Egypt from very much that period, and certainly the New Kingdom, which gives us so many of these great tombs which we associate that are more modern than pyramids, for example. And during the episode that we were presenting on the New Kingdom, we encountered the very radical pharaoh called Akhenaten, who we suspect was his wife Nefertiti, and who we suspect was his son Tutankhamun. So let's go back and listen. So Egypt would be at its most powerful extent for some time after Thutmose III's lifetime and right up into the 14th century BCE. Various pharaohs ruled Egypt and maintained its great extent. Thutmose III's bloodline would continue the dynasty until his great-grandson Amenhotep III became the pharaoh in the early 14th century BCE. This was a great cultural period of the New Kingdom. Amenhotep III would have a son who would succeed him as the pharaoh of Egypt, and he would come to reign as Amenhotep IV. Amenhotep IV is an incredibly unique and important individual when it comes to discussing the course of events of the New Kingdom. Now, traditionally, the Theban dynasties of the Middle Kingdom and the New Kingdom regarded Amun as the prime deity of the city of Thebes in favour of Montu. When the New Kingdom emerged out of Thebes, Amun's status as an important deity became a national thing. However, at some point during Amenhotep IV's reign, he decided that things needed to change. He and his wife, Nefertiti, the heads of Egypt at a time of great wealth and power, decided to alter the religious position of the country. Amenhotep IV is believed to have despised the power that the Church of Amun had in Egypt, and he outlawed the worship of Amun and any other deity other than his own chosen deity, Aten, the sun disk. This was utterly radical. Not only did Amenhotep IV introduce Atenism as the kingdom's religion, but due to his outlawing of other worship, Atenism changed Egypt from polytheistic to monotheistic, something that apparently happened to the Jewish people many hundreds of years later in respect of their deity Yahweh. Amenhotep IV changed his own name to Akhenaten, which translates to effective for Aten. And he would move Egypt's capital city to Amarna, a city that he designed and built for the worship of Aten. Excavations from Amarna, which exists as an archaeological site in the Minya governorate of modern Egypt, suggest that Akhenaten did not wake up one morning and completely overhaul the entire religious attitude of Egypt. Due to the fact that many artifacts relating to Egypt's other deities have been discovered there from this period, it suggests that Akhenaten probably tried to gradually impose his will over the people of Egypt. The people of Egypt were really not ready to break away from hundreds of years of religious tradition and belief, and this only served to strain the relationship between the people and their pharaoh. Akhenaten would have a son who would also receive a name relating to the sun disk deity Aten. His name was Tutankhaten, which translates as the living image of Aten. After Akhenaten's lifetime, the Amarna period, which represented his will to change the religion of Egypt, came to an end. Akhenaten would come to be regarded as a heretic, even by his own son Tutankhaten,
who would allow the religion of Egypt to return to its original condition and subsequently change his own name to honour the Theban god Amun, and therefore he would come to be known as Tutankhamun. As we briefly discussed previously when talking of sister wives in Egypt, it may be the case that Tutankhamun was the product of a sexual relationship between his father Akhenaten and Akhenaten's own sister. This is strongly suggested by DNA tests of mummified remains. Worse still is the fact that Tutankhamun's wife was actually his half-sister Ankhesenamun, daughter of Akhenaten and Nefertiti. Tutankhamun and his half-sister would attempt to procreate. Now, modern science tells us that incestuous relationships do not produce the healthiest offspring, and we have the suggestion of incestuousness going on in the Egyptian royal family in absolute abundance, possibly believing that royal blood was in some way divine and this practice was wholly correct. Tutankhamun was the father of two stillborn daughters. Tutankhamun himself suffered from cleft palate, scoliosis, bone fusion of the neck, and a deformity of the foot caused by defective bone tissue. Could all of this have been the result of too much inbreeding? We also know that Tutankhamun was bitten by mosquitoes and probably caused him to contract malaria, and we know this thanks to the DNA studies of his mummified body. This is reported to be the earliest known proven case of a human contracting malaria. Nonetheless, it does appear that Tutankhamun, no more than a teenager when he died, was held in great esteem by his people, who deified him during his lifetime, possibly due to the fact that he restored the Egyptian ability to worship Amun and the pantheon of deities that were traditional to the Egyptians. His tomb in the Valley of the Kings was almost completely intact when it was discovered in 1922. Over 5,000 artifacts were found buried alongside the young pharaoh. One of the most iconic and recognisable artifacts of ancient Egyptian culture is the golden death mask of Tutankhamun recovered from his tomb. The golden mask was carefully created with the addition of lapis lazuli, quartz, obsidian, carnelian, turquoise, faience, and other precious and semi-precious stones. This demonstrates a richness in the trade network, at the very least. The mask and the pharaoh himself are highly iconic of ancient Egypt. Magazines and books on the general subject of ancient Egypt frequently feature the image of the death mask among their cover art.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of the History of the World podcast, a retrospective look at some of the subject matter that we were talking about on this day in previous years that this podcast has been active. We received a message this week from Vibeke Moore. And if you remember, Vibeke was the History of the World podcast Illuminati member who requested the podcast episode on the subject of the Yamnaya culture that we discussed last week. And she wrote in and said, "Hi Chris, thank you ever so much for the episode on the Yamnaya. It was both intriguing and inspiring, solid and respectful towards lacking facts and the many hypotheses. I like your openness and honesty very much. Your podcast on history is really the very best, and I have tried many. All the best from your loyal follower from Norway, Vibeke Moore." Well, Vibeke, it's thanks to people like you that I'm able to invest into this project and make it even better than I would otherwise if I was just, if I was just doing it all off my own back. So thank you, Vibeke. You earned that right. And I'm thankful that you wrote in and expressed your pleasure about the episode. You can go so much deeper into Yamnaya culture, and there are publications, I think I discussed this last week on the subscribers episode, that you can dig so much deeper into Yamnaya facts and aspects by sort of, you know, getting books on the subject. And there are a number of papers that have been published from the various educational establishments, and so you can dig a bit deeper. Obviously, my podcasts are only ever a general overview, so there's plenty out there if you're interested in finding out more. Brandy Borba has written in and has said, "Hi Chris, my name is Brandy and I'm from Fresno, California. Like you, I did not study history, but I've always had a passion for it. I have been on a quest to find something that presented history cohesively when I found your podcast. While I enjoy the depth of media that studies specific civilizations or regions, I find it hard to consolidate the information with that of other civilizations and regions. It is incredibly helpful that you present what is happening in all parts of the world at the same time, specifically during your summary episodes. Despite having a broader subject matter than most other podcasts, you take the time to provide detailed stories that really give listeners a glimpse into life during that time period. It is clear that you put a lot of time and effort into producing this show, and it is greatly appreciated. I was sceptical at first when I saw that the show started in prehistory, as that has never been a particularly interesting era to me, but was pleasantly surprised by the content you presented. You not only provided fascinating information, but also made information that I otherwise would have found boring, enjoyable to learn. One of the things I especially liked about Volume 1 was the discussion about how scientists have been able to make these discoveries, and like you mentioned in an unscripted episode presenting the history of discovering the history. Will this be something you continue with throughout the series? I loved hearing about how the context of when discoveries are made impacts the interpretation of these discoveries. I hope this is something you can bring back as you get into more modern history, providing the same stories of discovery from the other side and how they impacted the contemporary world. I just finished Volume 1 and I'm looking forward to Volume 2, as ancient history is one of my favourites. I am very excited to learn more about Mesopotamia, objectively the coolest civilization. I do have a request if you have time. In addition to the maps you make, would you be able to provide images or diagrams of things discussed in the episodes? I found it somewhat difficult to follow your episode on Stonehenge just because I did not know a lot of the terminology and therefore had a hard time understanding the details you were describing. It would be really cool to see pictures of the artifacts you have mentioned, such as an example of cuneiform or an example of prehistoric pottery. This is such a great podcast. It makes me so happy to see how many episodes I have yet to listen to. I admire your dedication to this project and your ability to produce a wonderful resource for all of us nerds. Thanks again, Brandy." Well, thank you, Brandy. Such a good message. And yeah, you touched upon a few things, which really I do find it time to sort of devote my personal time to such a lot of the podcast. You see this when I'm having to do these unscripted episodes. It's really because I've run short of time, and of course juggling this podcast with my personal life and, you know, commitments to my family, it's all very difficult to be able to keep up with it. But thankfully, thanks to the people who support the podcast, I'm able to do it. So and certainly things like enhancing the indexing of the podcasts and the material that relates to the episodes or the information within the episodes would be something I would love to devote more time to. So hopefully sometime in the future, maybe that is something that I'll be able to do. But thanks for your message, Brandy. Anyway, that's it for this week. Next week, hopefully we'll be bringing you the evolution of religion. What a challenging episode that will be, but it will be incredibly interesting nonetheless. But until then, thanks for listening. And don't forget to listen, if you are a History of the World podcast Illuminati member, to the subscribers only episode. So you'll be able to find either on Patreon or on Spotify. But until then, thanks for listening and be good.
The History of the World podcast, written and presented by Chris Hasler. Please consider making a financial contribution by going to the historyoftheworldpodcast.com website and clicking on the Patreon link. Email the show at historyoftheworldpodcast@mail.com. And don't forget to join our social media at Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. See you next time.